This is the First Time Podcast.
It's us talking writing and publishing.
Welcome to our Masters series,
where we interview Australian and international authors at the top of their games.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to the First Time Podcast.
Masters series.
A quick note to let you know that some of the audio in this episode is not at the quality we normally give you. We've done our best to correct this, but we've also made a full transcript of the episode available. You can find it on the episode webpage at thefirsttimepodcast.com. I was a fan of Margot Lanigan long before I was a writer, but it was her interview with Charlotte Wood in the collection The Writer's Room which really pushed her to the top of my wish list. Margot Lanigan has published two dark fantasy novels, Tender Morsels and Sea Hearts, seven short story collections, including the breakout Black Juice, 10 teenage romance novels, three junior fantasy novels, two young adult novels, and a children's picture book. She collaborated with Scott Westerfeld and Deborah Biancotti on the New York Times bestselling YA superheroes trilogy, Zeros. Look, I don't normally list all of a writer's awards, and this following list is absolutely not definitive, but it seems to remain that outside certain circles, here in Australia, Margot Lanigan still does not get the acclaim she so richly deserves. So, Margot Lanigan's work has won numerous awards, including 4 World Fantasy Awards, 9 Aurealis and 5 Ditmar Awards, 2 CBCA Awards, a Victorian and a Western Australian Premier's Literary Award, an Indie, the Barbara Jeffers Award and the Norma K. Hemming Award. In Australia, she's been shortlisted for the Stella Prize for the New South Wales and Queensland Premier's Literary Awards. Her international award listings include the Los Angeles Times Book Prize, the Dublin Impact Award, the Frank O'Connor International Short Story Award, the Astrid Lindgren Award twice, the Commonwealth Writers Prize, the British Science Fiction Association Awards, the British Fantasy Awards, the Carnegie Medal, the Nebula, Hugo, Bram Stoker, Theodore Sturgeon, Shirley Jackson, James Tiptree Jr., Michael L. Prince, and the International Horror Guild Awards. Her books and stories have been translated into 19 languages. I do hope you enjoy this conversation. Margot Lanigan, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us on the First Time Podcast.
I'm very pleased to be here.
I think I told you when I asked you to be part of the Master Series, I said that I have a very well-thumbed, well-marked, well-underlined interview with you. This is the one here I want to show you in Charlotte Wood's The Writer's Room. And I was reading back over it in preparation for this conversation, and it really is the most perfect interview, so much so that I almost was like, oh, maybe I'll just like tell our listeners to read this and I won't need to talk to Margot at all. But of course I wanted your particular insights, but I really do urge our listeners to go to that interview that you did with Charlotte for The Writer's Room, because it's just a wonderful overview of your writing life, but also has such great craft insights as well. So thank you for that, because it has kept me going at low points in the writing process. We always like to begin at the beginning, which is very hard for you. It's kind of nebulous moments of when you became different types of writers, I suppose. Yeah. So when do you mark the point of knowing that you wanted to be a writer?
Oh, look, I think I had that moment where I thought, well, that is something that I can do, and that might end up being, it probably won't be, I don't think I ever thought that it was really, I was really going to make a fabulous living from it. But I thought, well, if I'm going to make it into a second income stream, if we think about it in cold terms like that, I was probably thinking about that in the late 80s through the 90s, you know? And I think because I had some experience with editing and I saw the state in which a lot of manuscripts arrived at their publishers, and I thought, heck, you know, I'm doing all this fixing up of stuff. I could write as decent a first draft as this is and fix it up for publication myself. I was mostly editing nonfiction stuff, so I didn't have much of a chance to picks up other people's fiction.
I love that, like one of our other guests and one of my dear friends, Penny Russin, you had a similar kind of first move from editing into writing kind of teen romances for various publications under different names. What did you learn about story and, I suppose, the writing process when you were doing those books?
I think the most important lesson from those was keeping the motor running in a story, you know, just keeping things moving, keeping pages turning, you know, giving your reader something that makes them want to find out even a little bit more, you know, to get them over the next page. Filling up 100 pages with stuff that's going to make people want to keep on reading was probably the most useful thing I learned with that. And also that routine that I talked about in the interview with Charlotte, where, you know, some days you have good days and some days you have bad days, and then you know, you go back and you read over your full draft and you realise that you can't really tell the difference between the good days and the bad days. So there's this kind of level of okayness that you can rely on. So you don't actually need to be sitting there anguishing about what a bad day you're having, because that's okay. It's, you know, this is just one of those ones where you've got mind's getting in the way a bit more. So clear it away, just keep going, plod on, and all will be well.
Because you had also done, you know, kind of the sums to work out how long you could afford to spend on each of those books. I remember Penny talking about the same kind of thing, and that helped to just keep those words ticking over. I think often the space that we allow ourselves to kind of wallow around in our creativity means the words never get on the bloody page.
Absolutely, absolutely. I've had a terrible problem with this over the last several years when that Zero series gave me enough money to actually stop working for a while, and I just oceans of space, and it was just the worst time. You know, the most productive time was when I had two young children, and I was just cramming all the writing into the interstices between, you know, taking care of them and doing editing work and, you know, being, trying to be a good partner and all those, you know, running all these other lives at once. And as soon as there's space for the fear to creep in, I think it does.
I actually went back to your wonderful blog, which is this incredible archive of kind of a writing life. And I'm conscious that we've just come out of school holidays here, and combined with, for me, additional COVID time, my kids have been off school for a month. And on your blog in 2005, I think it was, after a period of school holidays, you wrote, "Sometimes writing is easy. Sometimes just getting the time to write is like trying to fight your way out of a large, wet, zipped up canvas tent that's collapsed on top of you." And I loved that. I was like, yes, that is how I feel. But I think the juggle is real at both ends of the scale, like what you described, that time where you are suddenly gifted, I suppose, is a word, or you're suddenly paid to write and then it's impossible. What kind of boundaries or strategies have you worked out over time get you in front of the page or the screen and get the words down?
Well, I think probably that sort of micro goals thing works the best. So you have a little list. You've got the enormous things that need to be fixed up, like, these are all my doubts about this. This character is not coming alive. Nobody has a name yet. I don't know the history of this. I haven't worked out the magic system. You know, and then all these things are just, you know, if you come at them first thing in the morning, they're really hard things to do. So you break it down and you say, well, I will make a list of the sorts of names that I like, that are sort of like this person, that I, you know, what I'll just throw a few names at it and see what happens. It doesn't matter if I choose one today, it doesn't matter if I choose one tomorrow. I'm working towards this thing. Or I will write this scene that I have been looking forward to, and I will leave the holy bits in, you know, I won't try and get it perfect. I'll just put square brackets around the crappy bits that I haven't written yet and that I haven't worked out yet. But I'll do the enjoyable bit first. And then perhaps some of the imagination that goes into those will leak out into the awkward bits and show me the way to make this scene whole, make this scene work.
I want to ask about inspiration in general, because you seem to come at things in a variety of ways. I've been looking at your scrapbooks, pictures of your mm-hmm. scrapbooks, which we'll talk about. And I suppose to get specific, I've just reread Singing My Sister Down, which had the same full body effect on me this time as the first time I read it. And I thought it was a good spot to start in talking about how you build worlds and where the inspiration for those kinds of stories come from, where you pluck those ideas and images from the world. So with Singing My Sister Down, where did that come from?
That came from, there was this SBS series long time ago called Global Village, and it just had these little these little 20-minute, half-hour sort of documentaries about different parts of the world. Quite a lot of them were French, and I think this was from former French Africa. And it was a story about those tar pits. And there were a lot of things from that documentary that just stuck with me. The fact that, you know, the kid went out and warmed their feet on the tar, and that there was every spring the men of the village would go and hoist this old lady's house back up the hill from where the tar pit had kind of dragged it out of shape. If, you know, if humans come to this place and they see this thing doing what it does, it's not a great leap for us to say, okay, well, this is where we can get rid of the people in our society that we don't approve of. And so that was the seed of it. And I had a post-it note saying, a family is forced to watch as justice is done while a family member is drowned in the tar. So that was the size of the idea that I had. So I knew that she was going to die, but I hadn't worked out the family and the relations until I picked that up. And then on the way to my job, when I went back to full-time work after a period of part-timing, I had this commute to and from work, and I just, okay, this is the idea for this week, and off I go, and I'll just get my train and write this up.
And did it come out almost fully formed? How is that process for you?
Yeah, that was one of the really quick ones. I go back to the first draft and it's pretty much all there. You know, there's just tweaking here and there. It was a marvellous thing. It hasn't happened very often, but that was one of them. It was just like, yeah, I know these people. And I was talking to I gave a class on secondary characters to my Faber people last night when we were talking about that story. And they said, how did you know to introduce all these secondary characters? And they came along and I was like, well, they kind of turned up when I needed them to, you know. I needed a family fitting, and needed some of them to be younger than him, and some of them to be older, and some to be wiser, and some to be stupider. And they all just arrived, you know, and I was sort of being carried along by the rhythm of his voice. And the events had a very strong forward movement anyway, moving towards, you know, there was the girl stinking in the tar, which is this process which is a horrible thing to witness and to describe, but a fascinating thing as well. Mm. And just all these things distracting him and also refocusing him on what's happening to this sister.
We could do an entire hour just on that story, so I'm going to make sure I pull myself up. But so much of, like that one, I think so much of your work, you know, the tar pit and the flowers, for instance, in that one, or even the singing and the crab and the tar, it springs from these juxtapositions and collisions of images and ideas. And I wanted to ask if you kind of actively have writing prompts or activities or strategies to get you into that mode of generation when you're, you know, slapping ideas together?
Not to get the ideas. I tend to sort of sit and wait for the activating one to come along. You know, I've got lots of notes for story ideas, and sometimes they don't happen until I don't think I've ever really sort of picked you up and jam them together. I have written notes to myself saying, maybe if I combine this with that, but I don't recall many stories actually coming together by that. But it's just when I'm thinking about some idea, and then you sort of This is my process for writing short stories. If I need to write a short story, and I have this chunk of idea, and it's like, that's a nice thing. I just like it for itself, but it is not yet enough to be a story. So I just lodge that in my brain and I cart it around with me. And when I have a relaxed moment where I'm and a sort of anticipatory moment, I can sit there and think, okay, what would, you know, or if I go on a bike ride, you know, and I just apply some oxygen to the idea, and then bam, something else jumps in, you know, something else that's nearby that's not quite related or just seems to strike sparks.
And do you just begin with the heat, with the words that come out? Do you plot down a shape or, you know, note down a shape, or do you just go with the words?
I'm very bad at complicated structures. So what I need is those two ideas that are giving each other energy to make something change. And I need to have a rough sense of something that will happen at the end. I need to feel that I'm moving towards something else. Otherwise I can just sit there playing with those two things and they don't go anywhere. You know, I remember drafting a long part of a novel which was just two very attractive characters having fascinating conversations, but nothing was happening because I didn't have that end point. I just need to have that. I just need something to move towards, but I don't necessarily need to have the mechanisms by which it's going to get there, every single one of them. I need to have a feeling that, oh, I can do interesting things with this. I can make interesting things happen on the way to that. But I don't necessarily have to have them fully mapped out.
Do you think that there's a beautiful line in that interview where you talk about having fairy tales kind of deep in your bones, and I imagine across, you know, a lifetime of reading, you've got story in general deep in your bones. Does that kind of subconsciously shape your story as you go along? Things like myth or fairy tale, that knowing how a story needs to flow and shape and move, do you think?
Up to a point it does. Up to a point you can rely on that, and then, but every now and again, this is the planning and pantsing conversation, isn't it? But every now and again you have, like it's good to start with some, it's good to feel free at the beginning so that you don't close off your options too fast. But you also want to just experiment with closing them off and seeing, okay, well, is this actually channeling the energy really well and making it really fierce and directed? Or is this leading me away from the thing that I felt in my gut was what this story was about? So you just have to follow your mood, and sometimes it's better to sit back and say, okay, well, this will happen and then this will happen, and then I can feel there is this kind of wobbly wasteland in the middle where I really haven't worked out how they're going to get across to the final bit now. What would be the most fun way to get there?
When you said before, you know, when I have to write a short story, are there times when the material also only presents itself as having the legs for a short story? You know, you've written novels, shorts, you know, bigger extended big novels. How do you know what's got the legs for a short story or a novel? Do you ever, does an idea surprise you in having more than you think it does or less sometimes?
I think, well, I'm much more frightened of writing novels. So I suppose it's got to have that feeling that whenever you prod at the idea, more juice comes out of it, you know, and more ideas accrete, you know, they sort of come along and glom onto it and offer other possibilities, you know, offer other whole stories associated with it. Like when I was writing Tender Morsels, I was really terrified because I'd had a couple of novels really crash and burn, and they just had not been able to proceed. And so what I did with that was I took that grim story, Snow White and Rose Red, and I thought, okay, well, I'm not going to write a novel based on this. What I'm going to do is I'm just going to write a bunch of short stories, and they will... The only rule that they have is they have to come in towards this story and they have to make contact with it at some point. It doesn't have to be, they don't have to be united in time or with characters. Come and make contact with this story. They can continue along with it as long as they like, or they can just have that contact point and then move straight away from it again. So I just wrote a bunch of weird stories around that fairy tale. And, of course, the brain is just a pattern maker. It just does these things, making these connections. So when I went back to all these, I did about 12 of them. Right? So I can think of this as a collection of stories. This is what's freeing me up. I don't have to think of the others. I don't make sure everything is together or connects or makes the same thing. And, of course, when I went back to them, I could see how they could knit together and make similar points to each other and see other possibilities for building them into something that was more unified.
I love that idea of the brain as a pattern maker, and also that trust that you obviously have that will work. Have you always had that, or is that something you've developed over your career and experience, the trust that the stories will make their own connections and patterns?
No, I think that trust comes and goes, you know. I think in the last several years, I've had a lot of problems trusting that will happen, and feeling cheerful about the enterprise, really, you know, just feeling, because, you know, we've been stuck away in our little burrows, not seeing anybody or doing anything, you know, or checking with the real world. And, you know, the world's just been blowing up in various ways. And in the middle of that, it's very hard to keep your spirits up generally. But also just you get to that, you sort of think, oh, I've been working at this so long. And every story I start seems to be turning into the same story. So little input now. And, you know, it's all sort of contrived. And because I am a certain sort of person, I just reach for the same sorts of things over and over again. I'm never surprised by new things coming into my life because my life doesn't go anywhere at the moment. And
that's really interesting. We had that similar conversation with Sarah Winman when she was saying that she's really struggled in the last couple of years to write, as so many of us have, but she identified the same kind of problem, that there was no input, there was nothing to push up against to get that tension that you and energy that you need to write. Because what would your, you know, in times of non-lockdown and pandemic, what does your kind of writing week or life involve? Are you collecting stories when you walk and getting energy from other people, from being in different groups, from travel? What does that all involve, Margot?
Well, you know, I'm still breadwinning, so I would be commuting to work, and I would be seeing all sorts of things, and I would be making, I would have music that I was listening to, a podcast that I still listen to podcasts, but, you know, there'd be stuff flowing past my eyes in the course of the day, and there'd be other people moving around me, you know, so close. Imagine sitting between two people on the train.
The train, I think the train is the greatest loss for so many writers, both the commute, that forced time where you can say, okay, I've got 40 minutes here to write, but also the observation, the paying attention to people and how they speak and move and interact with the world is, I've missed that so much.
I was sitting in a train once and the girl opposite me talking to her partner gave me the side eye and said, someone's got staring problems. So you have to watch it with your writerly observations.
You do. I always, when I'm working with younger students, I always tell them the trick I have of turning my font to white while I'm on a train, so I just type, but no one can see what I'm typing.
Yeah,
you can. Margot, the most, I'm jumping around here because it's also interesting, but the most underlined and flagged section of your interview with Charlotte for me, and the one that's had the most impact on me, I think, is the one where Charlotte asks you about how to make unfamiliar worlds seem familiar. And you explain how, and you use the example of sea hearts. And I quote, you say, you have to surround it, the thing, with a little convincing fog of interesting detail that you just make up out of nothing. And I think that I have carried this nugget, this kernel of wisdom around and try all the time. Don't explain it, Kate. Don't explain it. Just give it a couple of things. Can you explain how this works, please?
With the sea hearts themselves, that's the example that I used for Charlotte. I just needed something from the sea. I can't remember where. I think I'd seen sea urchins being harvested, and there was that whole thing of their sort of hairy, horrible outside and their weird, sloppy insides with the orange roe. And so I wanted something like that, but not quite identifiably that. I wanted that feeling that you pick up these ugly-looking things, but which are clearly alive on the beach, and they're all, I wanted them to be here, you know, cold and wet and horrible to pick up, and then they produce this sort of transcendental for the helping room. So, you know, you just steal some details from the sea urchin, how do they eat them? Well, something has to be done to them. So there's kind of this ritual of just boiling them up. Well, picking the right ones, you know, there's all that ritual of the boys having to pick nice fresh ones. You don't pick ones that are all sitting up on the tie rack, and just details like that. Like what's sitting around them on the beach? These boys have got expertise. There are older boys and younger boys. So the older boys, they don't pick up those dry, hard ones. Pick up these nice fresh ones. And mums will be very happy when you bring home these lovely ones. So those kinds of things, they just kind of grow. But as you're looking around the scene, you're looking around the scenery and you're looking among the characters,
there's a great part too where you go on to describe how I'm not sure that you're specifically talking about science fiction or fantasy, but when you say, you know, your characters don't go around explaining the world that they're in to themselves. And I think that that's something that we tend to do. Emerging writers or more inexperienced writers don't have yet the trust in their reader to fill those gaps, so they do explain everything over and over again. What advice do you give to writers you're working with about trying to cut some of that out?
Oh, just put it all in to start with so that you know what's going on, because often you're working it out as you're writing those explanations down, and then when you go back and you realise you've done that and you've been too obvious and they're sounding unnatural, then you say, okay, well, if this is laying it all out in too much detail and too clearly, what ways can I convey this elsewhere or by a more casual sort of a remark that says the same thing off to one side rather than directly?
Do you do a lot of that in drafting and editing, Margot? Or, you know, I imagine at this point in your career that comes more naturally to you, but how much kind of rewriting and cutting do you do in your editing process?
Depends on the story. As I said, some of them and scenes within a novel as well, you know, some of them will stay stable throughout the whole project, and then others will go through many, many remakings, or, you know, and that sometimes the whole structure is remade at the editorial stage. With Tender Morsels, it went through two big sort of seismic, as two different sets of went over it, or, you know, two different stages. You know, I remember making it over, but, you know, the things that the editors told me made me, I see why they've got that idea wrong, I see where I've gone wrong here, and it was really clear to me how I could remake it. But it wasn't really clear to me. I remember my partner had a broken pelvis and he was stuck for 6 weeks on the couch in front of the television, and I was supposed to be rewriting this novel. I decided the best way to rewrite the novel was to lie on the other couch. And what was really weird was I had this deadline. It was to get it done just before Christmas. And like 2 weeks before Christmas, I thought, you know, well, I better go and do this novel. And I went and I sat myself down, and all that time my brain must have been just cooking quietly away. And I knew that I had these 2 weeks, and I knew that I couldn't get it done. And I thought, well, the best I can do is just sit down and work on it every day, and we'll see what happens, and blah, blah, blah. And in the 2 weeks, it was done.
Wow.
It was just insane. You know, so there's some, you know, it's sort of like, yeah, I've got all this. I know what my story is. I've wandered in that land for a long time. It's inside me. I'm sort of here absorbing everything that those people have told me. They're all doing their, you know, it's like a chrysalis, you know.
Yeah.
Caterpillars melting and the butterflies forming. And then at some certain point, I know, okay, well, I've only got to start now. Here comes butterfly. And it didn't feel like a butterfly when it was emerging. It felt like I was just sort of slogging away day by day. But in fact, your idea of it, and it was much less traumatic, except for all the, you know, self-flagellation that went on. Much less traumatic than if I'd sat down straight away, I think, and started to try and blend the two together.
At that point, Margot, because they can be such unwieldy things to deal with, novels and restructures, are you doing that, you know, on cards on the floor or on a whiteboard, or are you doing it on paper or all on in a document? How do you do those kinds of big structural move arounds?
I'm better now at using spreadsheets, but I tend to do it with a printed manuscript, and it works best if I do it as a whole. And then there will be places where I can't sit within that manuscript and work out everything that's going on in this section. And then I will have to make a list of things and work out what each little bit of thing is in, and if it's moving in the right order. I'm doing that with the section of the novel that I'm writing at the moment, and I keep going back to it and still just doing it. And having to say, okay, well, I'll poke at this a bit today, and then I'll go away and work on one of the fun ones I've seen that I know is working, and that just needs polishing and tweaking. And then, you know, maybe my subconscious. One day I'll have such mental clarity that I'll come at this and I'll feel like, okay, now I know exactly what to do. And I'll be able to write. And I may actually rewrite the whole thing from scratch without reference to what I have done before, because all the material is in there, it's not in the right order, and it's not with the right emphasis. It might just be easier to start at the beginning of that.
Like literally recomposing from the beginning.
Yeah. For some scenes, I have to, because because after all the pegging away at them, they'll have bits that can never be made to fit together.
Mm.
And so it's better to do it as a kind of organic re-blurt than it is to try and cobble all the bits together that exist presently.
An organic re-blurt. I think that's an excellent technical term. And I wanted to ask you about language, because it's so thrilling to read your work. I picked up, you know, the books that I had around me of yours this morning just to get some examples, and immediately I had a smackle of something to eat, twisting like being squozen out, and then, you know, a bunch of compounds like moth signals, snow light, slick thighed, smoke meat. I love it. It reminds me of another fabulously clever friend, Zana Freilon, who does the same thing with language, and it always just thrills me. And so I want to know how you play with language this way and how you work out what's going to fit, how you even create sometimes these, they're not fully new languages, I don't even know what you would call them, but how do you do that? What's going on in the Margot Lanigan brain to make that happen?
I don't know. You know, I think I'm kind of always doing it, you know, I do it a bit in conversation, like the organic regular, you know, so I'm just not very rule-bound about what you can combine, I guess. And, you know, there is just that thing of, it's a bit like scrapbooking, you know, you put two words together and they create this energy between them that is more than the sum of their parts. But really, I think those things, I think that it's really hard for me to say how it happens, because it must happen when I'm in the flow and reaching for a word and the word doesn't quite exist, so I put down something. Sometimes it'll be an awful, clumsy, over-explanatory in square brackets, and sometimes it'll be a nugget like that. And, you know, there are certain points of intensity in the story where that kind of thing is permissible, and sometimes some places where it's just doesn't work.
When you're working in an extended story or where there is a language that a number of characters, language choices that a number of characters are making, vernacular, do you record that? Like, I'm thinking of when your editor sends you back your kind of your style guide and your word list. You know, do you do that yourself as you're writing, or is it contained within the world that you've built? Is it like the rules of magic or any other part of world building that it's just instinctive?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much contained in the work. Yeah, and sometimes editors have come back with little lists of the words. And sometimes what's really funny is when you have those words and they go through the editors and the editors are fine with it, and then it gets the copy editors, particularly the US copy editors, and these little notes in the margin saying, I'm unable to find evidence of the existence of this lizard in blah, blah, blah. Well, no, you wouldn't, I guess. Made that up on the spot.
Is that a fun part of it for you, for someone who is playful with language? Is that editorial between territories, I suppose? Is it ever generative in that way that, you know, you think, oh, that's a funny or an interesting or a new way of language from that particular set of editors?
I think it's just a private source of amusement. I think that earnestness is amusing.
Yes.
Because having been an editor myself and being a copy editor myself, I know that you can just get too narrowed down, and you can just get obsessive about one particular thing in this one manuscript, and you can just embarrass yourself by insisting on this thing. You start off thinking there's just one tiny change, and then you suddenly realize I've done all the way through, and then you. Am I going to go back and undo those changes, or am I going to insist on this thing for 300 more pages? And if you make the decision to insist on it, you really tie yourself in knots. And it's watching somebody else do it is really funny, or watching somebody just not get you is hilarious.
I've had, I remember once doing an interview with Ian McGold, who is both a writer and an editor, and remembering how physically she changed her kind of body language when she talked about her work as a writer and her work as an editor. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you have, when you're writing and in the creative process, do you almost, you know, wear two different hats as writer and editor? Do you have to ask the editor self to step outside of the room while you're in the composition stage and then invite them back in? Or do you now integrate both together, do you think?
I definitely have to tell that inner editor to pipe down on a regular basis, and just let things happen. Let me enjoy myself. Mm. But I enjoy the editing as well. You know, I enjoy coming back and, you know, you get the fresh printout and go through it again, and you can see what's working and what isn't. And there's a great pleasure in having a scene that you've got the skeleton is good, the bones are good, and there's also a particular bit in it where you know that you've hit the nail on the head, and getting everything to lead beautifully to that point and to craft a nice way out of the scene again that leads you on to the next. But it's just so much fun.
How do you know when you're done?
When you don't hit any of those knots, you know, I suppose if you're really, truly, and it's been a long time since I've submitted a novel for publication, but when you read aloud and there are no hitches and you know you've got the language right and you feel like everything's working, yeah. Mm.
I skipped over, I wanted to ask you about your scrapbooks, and I will put up some links to the images, which are incredibly beautiful. I know that you don't have them for every project. Have you got some going at the moment?
I have got some going, yeah. I've got this wheel book, which is something that I haven't had for other projects. It's my wheel book. Inside it is this little page of...
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of trying to capture the mood of the girl at the center. So, you know, it's a Selkie story again. I was trying not to make it Selkies, but it actually is. I can't get away from the Selkies. But it's also got those, see those, that scraggly looking heart there, and then that awful looking
yes
crown skull is the key thing. And then it's got a few, you know, experimental titles which may or may not stick.
And so this book, what did you describe it as? A wheel book.
A wheel book. I can't remember which writing advisor wrote about it. It was in some writing book. It said you have a wheel book that where you just go there and you blurt out everything you need to. So that's got, here's one of my chapter plans. That was, I worked on this story for several years and sort of felt that I'd written it into the ground, and then I left it alone for several more years, and I've just recently in the last 9 months come back to it thinking, look, I think I can actually fix this. And that was, you know, I wrote out this plan, and then as you can see, all my ticks in my tick column.
Yes, I'm very impressed by this.
And you know, and I just made myself do, you know, a chapter a day and get that done. And now I'm going back and fixing it up. But it's got, you know, every now and again I make myself stick in a picture that says something to me about the atmosphere of the thing. And it's just got all the thoughts that I have about it as I'm going. It's not ordered. I remember this woman who was talking about the wheel books. You know, you go in and you say, well, I wrote this scene today and I think it's going well, blah, blah, blah. Well, I don't really do that. I just go in there and I write any ideas that I have about things I might fix or ways I might proceed or stuff I might include goes in. And when I'm trying to work out the order of a scene, I go to this book and I put it in there.
Mm, like a catch-all.
Yeah.
You know that anything about the book is in there.
Yeah. But I think I put the pictures in there simply because looking at pages of notes is so dreary, you know, and it requires you to make that sort of jump. You know, your brain actually has to clank into gear to appreciate what you're saying and to make sense of it. Whereas if you these little sort of spurts of, these things are just instantly attractive to me and they instantly tell me something about what I'm trying for. So they're just little sort of, encouragements, I guess.
Mm. It's interesting. I think that both the information about your scrapbooks and then also an interview I heard with Favel Parrott when she was writing her latest book were both inspirations for the fact that now that I have a space to write in, and I didn't before, I was in the corner of a lounge room, and so I didn't have visual images up around me. But it's one of the things that I've concentrated on having in this space. Because I think of exactly that, the gentle effect of what they're doing behind the scenes, being immersed in those images all the time, or that kind of, the butterfly emerging in the chrysalis when you don't even know it's happening.
Yeah, and they're really useful for just things like characters. You know, if you've got several portraits, none of which are quite the person, but they, you know, put them all together on the same page with a few other images and you can sort of capture the feeling that you want to capture in your words. And if you go off track, you can always come back to the pictures, and the pictures will pretty much be insisting on what you originally put them together for.
That's so interesting that you talk about this book that you're working on now being one that, you know, you've kind of come back to, because there was another great line that was in one of your on blog posts where you talk about having tried this giant fantasy novel and a YA fantasy series, and you describe them all as having fallen to pieces in your hands. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you about, you know, what can be done when that happens and how to resurrect them. And that's obviously what you're, you know, what you're doing now.
Yeah. You know, every book falls apart in your hands at some point, and sometimes at several points. So you just, I think there are times when you can handle that and times when it's best to just walk away. And, you know, having come back to this book, I'm beginning to look at some of those ones which I thought had fallen apart in my hands and think, well, you know, if I approached them in the right spirit, I could possibly, because the ideas at the centre of them are still, I think, they're still good nuggets of ideas, and they're inviting all sorts of things to gather around them in an interesting way. So it's, you know, it's just a matter of what you can cope with at the time,
I think. I want to ask a little bit about kind of industry as a whole, we've gone granular in your process first. There's one, I think in an interview with the Stella Prize, you named Margaret Atwood as a writer you admire, and you say in past because she's a cross-genre writer who's not been pigeonholed. And you say, I suspect that comes of winning your adult literary stripes before your YA or fantasy ones. I've just done things in the wrong order. And I wanted to ask about this hierarchy of literary stripes. Obviously, it totally exists, but who perpetuates it? And do you think that it has changed over your time in the writing world, the hierarchy of where you get your lit stripes from?
No, I don't think it's changed very much. I remember hearing a story about how the publishers were trying to decide whether to publish Salman Rushdie's Midnight's Children as I think the choice was between genre and a literary work. And they decided they would go for the literary work because if they published him as genre, he would never escape genre. It was clearly them making that decision. Now, I came at it differently because I started off writing the romances. They were my sort of training wheels. And then I wrote children's fiction, and then I wrote gritty realist YA. And then I stepped over into sort of YA-ish, crossover-ish fantasy, and I've sort of sat in this uncomfortable space between YA and A ever since. And publishers need to know the market that they're selling into. Booksellers need to know the market that they're selling to. Booksellers seem to have a terrible problem putting a book into more than one place.
In the genre area or in any of those kind of worlds, do you find a place where that community of writers and readers is one that is the best fit for you?
Oh, look, I think probably the fantasy genre is, fantasy and science fiction community they're more flexible than, much more flexible than mainstream publishing or mainstream readers, actually. That they were the first to actually have separate YA divisions in their competitions, and they have always seemed to be very ready to include YA literature with the rest of the books that they're concerned with. I mean, it's really hard to say because I think these things are, I've probably said this in lots of interviews that you've already read. There are so many books, there are so many things to read, and our lives are so short. And we're always looking for, and you can hear it in the way people talk about books, we're always looking for ways to cut down on the things that we feel we ought to read. There are just so many. It's just handy to have a way to say, okay, I don't need to go over there. Like when I can tell when I speak to people and I introduce myself as a writer and I tell them what I have written and I say that it's published as YA, they say, okay, my cousin will like that. Okay, my son might. There's kind of this palpable relief. I don't have to actually, I don't have to be the one who's read the thing that you've written. It's not for me. Phew.
Which is such a shame in so many ways. And I agree with you, so many books, how do you even begin? But you also then can miss so many. I mean, that's what, booksellers are so incredible for. How do you work out now what to put on top of your reading list? What do you read and where do you find those books?
I'm just so disordered. Yeah, look. I just literally find them. Like there are street libraries now, and you just can't find horrible old yellowed books. Oh God, I remember when that came out, and there's such a fascinating habit. Have a go at that now. So I find them that way, and I also I listen to a lot of podcasts, and I listen and I take down things that I think I'll be like. And every now and again, I rein myself in and make myself go back and read some of those ones that I've purchased that way. But really, and then there's always that, I should also read the classics,
Are there books that you go back to? Are there books that were, touchstones for you as a writer and reader that you go back to and read again, or are you not a rereader?
I have reread a few recently. There's there's this YA duet that Elizabeth Knox wrote called Dream Hunter and Dream Quake.
I wanted to know, over your career, can you tell us something, maybe one thing you've got better at, and one thing, if anything, that is still as difficult as it was the first time?
I think I'm better at managing the on a close reading kind of way. I think I haven't got better at managing a larger field.
Like the
relevance of it at all, and the worth of what I'm doing at all. And then, you know, I always sort of come around from these circles of thoughts, thinking, well, what else exactly are you going to do? And, you know, remember when these people said that your work helped them, and, you know, through difficult times in their lives, and you thought that was enough reason to write. Well, it's still enough reason to write.
Margot, you've already given us heaps of wonderful advice. Is there some parting advice, though, that you can give our listeners on any aspect of writing, perhaps advice that was given to you or advice that you regularly give out?
Oh, there's that nice thing that George Saunders used to tell his, they used to tell their children as they went off to school, joy, not fear. Joy.
That's exactly it. Thank you, George Saunders and Margot. And Margot Lanigan, can you please recommend for us a debut book anytime or any place?
I can. I'm going to recommend one that's from 2010, I think. It's one of the books that we chose as a Vogel winner. It's called Night Street by Crystal Thornell, and it's a fictionalised biography of the painter Clarice Beckett. And I've been watching a whole bunch of videos of artists painting. There's this podcast, the Talking with Painters podcast, which has just got these great long and short interviews, plus also she's got a YouTube channel where she takes all this video and watches them working sometimes. It's fabulous. So I'm kind of in that headspace.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, and for giving us those extra juicy bits that we can go in and look at that with that book as well. Margot Lanigan, it's such a pleasure to speak with you. I can't even believe that the time has passed already, but I do hope that we get to chat again sometime, and thank you so much for speaking with us.
Well, it's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you.
You can find the show notes for today's episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. Get in touch with us via Instagram or Twitter at thefirsttimepod, or you can leave us a message on the website. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We record this podcast virtually on the unceded lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We pay our respects to elders, past and present, and we extend that to our First Nations guests and listeners. Sound production by Phoebe 80, who we can employ because of the wonderful support of our patrons via Patreon. Thank you so much for making this podcast possible.